Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The cattle grazed on the stubbly grass, letting out the occasional moo and bellow as the herd slowly moved across the pasture. They competed for space with a vast flock of sheep, hundreds of them bleating and chomping under the watchful eye of adolescent shepherds and their barking dogs. In the fields beyond, the farmers were weeding, pulling the pesky invaders out from among their carefully tended stands of wheat, sticking upward out of the rich black earth. The sky hung low here over the flat, grassy steppe, the land gently rolling into low hills and distant ridges, some of them far away covered with trees. As the sun began to dip lower toward the endless horizon, the shepherds drove their sheep and cattle into fenced enclosures for the evening. A few stuck around to keep watch for the predators, some of them four-legged, others walking around on two, who might try to make off with their precious animals during the night. The farmers gathered their tools. Others hefted large, finely painted pottery jugs full of milk. Together, they began walking down a slightly sunken, well-worn path that wound its way through the fields and pastures. Plumes of smoke rose in the near distance, dozens of fires sending their signals upward into the darkening sky. As they walked along the path, coming closer and closer to the source of all that smoke, a curving wall rose ahead of them. The path cut through a gap, and as they looked left and right, so did others, leading back out toward other pastures and fields. In reality, this wasn't a wall at all. It was comprised of rectangular houses, one butted up against the next, in a vast circle broken only by the incoming paths. The din of activity drowned out their footfalls. Bleating animals heaving bellows, pestles grinding, pottery shattering, chipping stones for sickles and knives, and above it all, voices. Thousands of voices. The exterior ring of houses surrounded another, smaller, circular ring, then another inside that, and another. The houses clustered together, leaving only enough space for those winding paths to reach through to the middle of the settlement. Acre after acre of houses, all of them filled with people going about their lives, made this the most populous place on Earth. 5,700 years ago, the lush, fertile forest steppe of the Ukraine was home to the largest agglomeration of people on the planet, a place now called Talyanki. This was one of the world's first cities, we might say, and it wasn't the only one. Sites like it, some of them about the same size, could be found all over the region. But unlike the urban centers of Mesopotamia, which are so often treated as the beginnings of civilization, these vast circular rings of houses in the Ukraine were forgotten, covered over by thousands of years of dirt. So too was the world they belonged to, the Copper Age of old Europe, an entire forgotten civilization lost to the mists of time. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The development and spread of farming changed humanity forever. But the transformations that went along with all of that didn't happen overnight. The Neolithic period lasted for a long time, some 6,000 years from the first stirrings of intentional cultivation in the Fertile Crescent to those maybe cities on the Ukrainian steppe, and then 1,000 more from there to the dawn of the Bronze Age. 7,000 years is an almost unimaginable span of time, long enough for whole civilizations to come and go and come and go, leaving behind only the faintest traces of their existence. Last time, we talked about the megalith builders of Western Europe, the Neolithic people who put up the enormous barrows and standing stones and passage graves that dotted the landscape from Scandinavia to Brittany to Ireland, leaving behind monuments that still survive today. To the east of there, in the Danube Valley, the Balkans, and the steppe just to the east of the Carpathian Mountains, the original homeland of farming in Europe, something quite different was happening. These people went in a much different direction than their Western cousins. They built settlements that grew and grew and grew to enormous sizes. They learned the secrets of copper and gold metallurgy. They created incredible pottery and art. And then, finally, they disappeared, almost wiped from the face of the earth. This was old Europe. From the northern Balkans to the fringe of the great Eurasian grasslands, this region was home to a coherent way of life that lasted for more than 2,000 years. In today's episode, we'll try to understand this very different Neolithic. No longhouses or megaliths here. How it grew, what life was like, and why it eventually came to an end. When I say coherent way of life, what exactly does that mean? Would the last people of old Europe, those living in the region around 2800 BC, really have seen much in common with their predecessors around 5000 BC? In other words, is old Europe really a thing we can talk about? We define archaeological cultures as brick-like entities. They seem a lot more solid than they really are. We lump together bundles of traits like house types, pottery types, styles of artistic decoration, tool technologies, field systems, and now increasingly genetic profiles, and we tend to treat them as a coherent package. This is called a monothetic approach to material culture. But in reality, archaeological cultures are polythetic. Most sites that we attribute to a particular archaeological culture only show some, or even just one, of the traits that we might associate with the whole culture. There's a ton of variation over space and time, even within pretty homogeneous archaeological cultures, like the LBK that I talked about in previous episodes. But with old Europe, I really do think it holds together, and I'll tell you why. Over this really, really long stretch of time, more than 2,000 years, some basic facets of life remained constant here. First, old Europe revolved around settlements and especially the home, rather than cemeteries or burials. Many of these settlements lasted for generation after generation after generation, and the focus on settlements eventually culminated in the megasites that I talked about. Second, old Europe was a ceramic culture. Pottery was a huge deal to them. They made sophisticated, intricate, beautifully decorated vessels and styles that were recognizably related to one another over this whole period. Stone, like the megalithic people further to the west, not so much. Third, there are long-term continuities, not just in settlements and houses, but in how people must have thought about those spaces. The people of old Europe made ceramic figurines, mostly female in appearance, that recur over and over and over again in domestic contexts. These goddess figurines, as they're called, are another form of long-term continuity. So even though there were disruptions and discontinuities and changes over those 2,000 years, I do believe that old Europe was coherent enough to stand as a civilization in its own right. The fact that it eventually fell apart and was forgotten for millennia, unlike Egypt or Mesopotamia, doesn't change that. So how did this particular culture slash civilization come into being? Where did it come from? We'll need to think back a few episodes to when we talked about the first farmers of Europe arriving in the Aegean just after 7000 BC. These folks had come from Anatolia, if you'll recall, heading west via two routes. Overland through the mountains, hills, and plateaus, and also via the coastline of what's now southern Turkey. They hopped from landing spot to landing spot before showing up on the Aegean islands and the coast of mainland Greece. These first farmers of Europe became the source populations and source cultures from which farming then spread west and north into Europe. One stream of migrants went directly west after about 6000 BC. It showed up in Italy and then the western Mediterranean before jumping inland. These were the cardial and epicardial culture people that we talked about a few weeks ago. The other stream of migrants went north. They occupied the Great Thessalian Plain and then the northern Balkans before stopping in the long valleys that made up the corridor of the Danube River by about 6200 BC. A frontier group along the upper Danube, straddling what's now the border between Austria and Hungary, much later became the source for the LBK farmers who spread into Central and Western Europe after about 5500 BC. The LBK way of life, as we talked about, was quite distinctive. Big timber longhouses set on islands of fertile loose soil, where they intensively cultivated small plots of land with a limited set of crops and livestock. Their settlements weren't particularly organized. Whatever social group, like a family or clan, lived in a longhouse pretty much operated as its own unit. Groupings of longhouses could be found in settlements, sometimes ones with hundreds of inhabitants, but they weren't aligned along streets. There were no public buildings or even communal spaces. When there were signs of collective effort, especially wooden palisades and earthen embankments in the later stages of the LBK, they were presumably the work of leaders rather than organized communities. Longhouses also weren't occupied for that long. A few decades, maybe. Some settlements lasted a few generations. This was the archaeological culture that spread out extensively through much of Europe, and eventually reached all the way from the Netherlands and northern France to Poland and the western Ukraine. But back in the Danube corridor and the Balkans, things were much different. This was the heartland of the European Neolithic. There were far more people. The land was settled much more extensively. The package of crops and livestock was much more diversified, and there was a great deal more continuity in the places that people lived generation after generation after generation. This region eventually became the core of Old Europe. This is what eventually gave rise to the megasites on the Ukrainian forest steppe. That was a long way off, though. In the early days of settlement in the Carpathian Basin and the Danube Corridor, we're talking about small pioneer settlements carrying the traditions of their ancestors in the Aegean northward into the Balkans and beyond. We can see a whole bunch of these continuities already. In their suite of crops and domesticated animals, although they focused a little more on cattle than sheep and goats, because cattle were better suited to their cooler new environment. In their house types and settlement layouts. In their pottery, which looked pretty similar. And in their genes, which suggests that they were the direct descendants of those first Aegean farmers. Just as the first expansion into the Aegean had been, and the LBK would later be, this was a really quick move. Within 200 years, or about 8 generations, thousands and thousands of square miles of new territory had been occupied. And as in those cases, as the genetics show, this was almost entirely a demic expansion. The farmers had lots of children who then occupied new territory. Only around the iron gates of the Danube, the narrow gorge that's now the boundary between Serbia and Romania, were the Mesolithic hunter-gatherers numerous enough for this to be anything other than a massive migration of new arrivals. Once it was established, which again happened really fast, these communities stayed in contact with their progenitors in Greece and the Aegean. For quite a long while, until at least 5500 BC, so 700, 800 years, we're really talking about one extended series of closely related cultures. The Starchevo in Serbia, the Kurus, Krish in Hungary and Romania, and the Karanovo in Bulgaria. There were regional variations in pottery styles, but all of them were built on the same material foundations they'd brought as they migrated north and west. You could find the same rectangular houses with a large central multipurpose room, the same kind of pottery vessels made with the same basic technological approach in the choice of clay, and the tempering process, which involved cereal chaff, and so on. We have to imagine that at this point, they mostly spoke a single language or several closely related dialects all over this region. After about 5800 BC, these people moved still further. They edged through the Carpathian Mountains and onto the fringes of the Great Eurasian Steppe, where they met communities of hunter-gatherers who lived in the forested river valleys. For a long time, about 1,000 years, this frontier held. It marked the eastward limit of the farming expansion. To the east of this line, marked by the Dniester River, lay the foragers and fishermen of the steppe. To the west, stretching from the eastern foothills of the Carpathians to the middle of the Danube Valley, was the emerging civilization of Old Europe.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
By 5000 BC, the farmers of Old Europe had already been living in this region for more than 1,000 years. Over that period of time, they had developed their own traditions and life ways, expressed in everything from house styles to religious beliefs. This wasn't a homogeneous region. At this point, there were probably multiple languages or at least strongly separated dialects, stretching from what's now the Ukraine to Moldova to Bulgaria to Romania to Hungary. There were variations in subsistence practices and settlement patterns, depending on precisely where you were. But the commonalities were more important than the differences, and even if the languages weren't mutually intelligible, their cultural practices absolutely were. Let's start with settlements and houses. Across much of this region, settlements were extremely long-lived. People built their villages on a spot and then built their new homes right on top of the old ones again and again and again for centuries or even longer. After a while, the deposits of material that went along with daily life, discarded rubbish, disintegrated organic material, shattered pottery, and especially debris from wattle and daub or mud brick houses, well, all of that material thickened. This is a common thing on any archaeological site. You'll see a settlement layer if there are enough people living anywhere for long enough. Usually they're a few centimeters wide, maybe a meter if the occupation was intense and long-lived. But in some parts of old Europe, the deposits got thick enough to form large artificial mounds called tells. Tells could be anywhere between 8 and 35 feet tall, rising out of the surrounding plains, covered with their rectangular houses and sometimes protected by walls and embankments. Tells were common in old Europe. There were dozens of them dotting the landscape, each one home to its village, surrounded by its fields and its flocks. They were essentially monuments, in the same way that the barrows and megaliths we talked about were monuments. The difference was that people lived on tells, and they did so for a very, very long time. Why would you build over and over again, in some cases for as long as several thousand years, right on the same spot? Probably, scholars argue, because they were both a reflection of and part of what created long-term communities and the cultural systems that went along with them. This kind of thing doesn't just happen by accident. Most settlements come and go. People live there for a few generations, maybe a few centuries, and then they disappear. They go elsewhere. Deciding to live on the same spot was no less a deliberate choice than moving. When I talk about the long-term continuities of life in old Europe, the tells are a perfect example. People living on them had to have been aware of a connection to the people who had come before them. By consciously making the decision to keep living in the same physical location, they were honoring and continuing their ancestors' way of life. They were marking their rootedness to this spot in the landscape. They did that by consciously landscaping the mounds. They intentionally leveled them. They removed the rubble and the remains of old houses. And sometimes they intentionally burned their old homes before rebuilding their new homes right on top of the ash. Like a phoenix, the entire settlement or an entire house would be reborn. One scholar, Paul Rakshi, sums it up like this, quote, "The mound itself may hence be seen as the material manifestation of a community, its coordinated activity and communal life. These were all communal activities. They were done collectively, with the settlement on the mound embodying the lives and beliefs of the people who occupied it. This wasn't just a collection of individual households. It was a community with a collective existence and collective values. There were some communal buildings aside from the houses. There were places with special functions. Ditches, earthworks, and walls protected the tell, and they literally enclosed it. They set it off from what lay outside. Over time, some of the houses on the tells got bigger and more substantial. By Old Europe's peak, between about 4500 and 4200 BC, there were big two-story constructions popping up amid the single-level homes, which were often arranged in neat rows or circles on top of the mound. Now, not everybody was equal, mind you. The bigger two-story houses presumably belonged to more important people within the community. These may have been communal places, but not everybody was the same. Not all the houses in a tell settlement were intentionally burned, for example. That honor seems to have gone to the important people, maybe clan elders or leaders, as part of a ritual of purification or renewal. No matter what size the house was, it was more than just a place to sleep at night. The house and the social unit it contained had some meaning. They were a thing unto themselves, and together, these households made up the community. What we see is an interlocking two-part system of rootedness at both the household and the community levels, expressed in the tell and the houses located on top of it. How do we know that? How can we see it? Well, primarily through one of the defining features of old Europe, those ceramic figurines, most of which seem to be more or less feminine. They fit easily in a person's hand. They have a narrow, indistinct face and neck broadening to wide hips and thinner legs. They're usually decorated with incised or painted lines and circles, and they're quite beautiful. Some of them are seated on chairs or thrones, either individually or in groups of 12 or 20. And they are everywhere in the tell sites of old Europe, dozens or hundreds of them, in house foundations and trash heaps, just everywhere. I'll put up some pictures on my Substack so you can see them. They're really striking and distinctive, and I can almost guarantee you've never seen anything like them before. And definitely nothing 7,000 years old. These are what the archaeologist Maria Gimbutas called goddess figurines, and she used them as the basis for a series of elaborate and influential theories in the 1970s and 1980s. That old Europe was matriarchal, female-centered, and egalitarian. That it had folklore and pantheons of deities, and that it was female-centered and focused around fertility, shadows of which survived up to much later times. And last of all, that this society had been destroyed violently by invaders from the steppe, the speakers of Indo-European languages who were patriarchal and hierarchical in contrast to the egalitarian matriarchal people of old Europe. Most scholars today accept few or none of Gimbutas' ideas, although they remain really popular and important and influential. She was an incredibly knowledgeable archaeologist with in-depth knowledge of the sites of old Europe, but most of her broader interpretations don't really fit the evidence. We'll come back to the steppe later today, and especially in next week's episode. That part of her argument bears closer examination. It's held up a lot better. But as far as the figurines were concerned, Gimbutas built a really elaborate explanatory edifice on some pretty thin stuff. We know the figures were real, and they were widespread. But were they representations of deities at all, much less of a distinct and defined pantheon? And do feminine figures automatically mean that the people who incorporated them into their daily lives were matriarchal? The answer to both of those questions is no. We shouldn't assume either of those things. Our ability to get inside the heads of these people 7,000 years ago and understand what these figurines meant to them is either non-existent or, at best, really limited. Having a bit of humility about the limits of our imagination is not a bad thing. With that said, we don't have to leave it at that. The distribution of the figurines isn't random. They show up in particular contexts and places, like house foundations and the boundary ditches at the edges of settlements. We can tell that they were everyday objects. They were constantly around, hovering on the edges of old Europeans' vision. They handled them. They set them up in their chairs. They placed them in miniature houses with miniature ovens. It's hard to say what this meant, but the people of old Europe presumably saw themselves reflected in the figurines, at least in some way. Maybe they saw their ancestors. Maybe they saw virtual representations of themselves. Or sure, maybe they saw deities, though what they understood by deities may not have much to do with our conceptions of the divine. Whatever they meant, they were everywhere. Dozens, hundreds, even thousands of them have been excavated from individual settlements. When those houses on the tells were intentionally burned, for whatever ritual or spiritual reason, there were figurines inside, in the walls and in the foundations. I think it's safe to say that these people felt really deeply connected to their homes, both the houses they lived in and the settlements in which they were grouped. That sense of place was part of what made them who they were, both as individuals and as a community. The figurines must have been part of that in some way. The variations between the figurines, and they did vary in shape, size, and number from place to place, well, that must have reflected or spoken to the distinctions between communities and households, even as they were part of this much broader cultural tradition that we can call Old Europe. These famous figurines were ceramics. They were made of clay, they were shaped, and they were fired in kilns. Old Europe was, more broadly, what we call a ceramic society. Clay was its most distinctive medium of expression. The pottery from Old Europe was incredibly finely made. A lot of it was fired at extremely high temperatures, much higher than the pottery of the LBK or Cardial people we've talked about earlier. Being fired at higher temperatures meant that it could be thinner, finer, and more durable. The decorations could be incredibly complex. Incised lines, stamps, and later swirling painted designs in shockingly bright colors made from exotic materials. All of that spoke to a high level of technological development and craft specialization. If you were making pottery like that, it probably wasn't something you did on the side in your spare time. You were a potter with specialized skills that not everybody held. We can see this spatially, too. Pottery kilns are often found in workshops on the edges of settlements rather than in among the homes. Fine pottery led directly into another of old Europe's defining aspects, the use of copper. Copper metallurgy was the earliest form of metalworking in human history. Now, it didn't first develop in old Europe. The first signs of copper metallurgy show up in Anatolia, back in the farming homeland. But it was quickly introduced across the Aegean, and old Europe was where copper metallurgy really blossomed and developed. Why there? Well, probably because of the pottery. If you knew how to get a pottery kiln super hot, then you could get any kiln hot enough to separate copper from its ore. At first, that produced fine beads of metal that could be hammered and shaped into small pieces of jewelry like rings or pendants. Later on, as the fires got hotter and the techniques improved, increasingly skilled metal workers, again, specialists, could cast entire objects in molds using liquid copper. With casting, metal workers could produce larger, heavier, and more useful items, like axes and daggers. Old Europe was the heartland of the copper-using world. Several mines in the region produced huge quantities of copper ore, tons and tons of the stuff, and the settlements closest to those mines seemed to have specialized in the production of increasingly sophisticated copper items. The copper mined and smelted in Old Europe became a valuable luxury trade good. It showed up in rich burials deep into the Eurasian steppes, hundreds of miles to the east. In fact, building on what they'd learned about copper, Old Europe is where some of the earliest gold artifacts in the world have been found, from a cemetery on the Black Sea coast of Bulgaria at Varna. Gold scepters, jewelry, diadems, bull figurines, more than 3,000 gold artifacts in total. The important people buried at Varna, chieftains or leaders of some kind, were showing wealth and social hierarchy in a way that didn't exist anywhere else in the world. Nobody else was doing anything like this. As the archaeologist David Anthony puts it, quote, "In 4500 BC, before the invention of the wheel or writing, before the first cities were built in Mesopotamia and Egypt, Old Europe was among the most sophisticated and technologically advanced places in the world. The tells rose up out of the landscape of Old Europe, covered by houses and protected by their earthen ramparts and wooden palisades. They were at the center of the settlement pattern, the places where people like the chiefs buried at Varna lived and exercised some sort of power and control over the surrounding region. Towns grew up around the tells. They extended outward for acres. More dispersed settlements, flatter than the mounds, cropped up in the spaces between the tells. Orderly fields and pastures filled the rest, a mature, human-created landscape. By 4300 BC, Old Europe had existed for thousands of years. But it didn't last forever. Change was coming, and soon the tells would be abandoned, left as silent monuments to a lost way of life."
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Old Europe didn't exist in isolation from the world around it. To the north and west lay the LBK culture and its successors, like the Michelsberg and Funnelbeaker people we talked about in our episode on the megaliths. To the south, there were the Neolithic cultures of the Balkans and Greece, still closely connected to the other side of the Aegean and Anatolia. That was where copper smelting had first come from, if you'll recall. And to the northeast, curling around the rim of the Black Sea, was the steppe, the vast grassland that stretched all the way from the Ukraine in the west to the fringes of China in the east. The people living on the steppe were different from those of Old Europe. The people who climbed up the tells scattered around the Danube were mostly the descendants of migrants from the Aegean and Anatolia. The people living in the steppe were mostly the descendants of local foragers who'd been in the region for thousands of years. The steppe people were hunter-gatherers who fished for sturgeon and catfish in rivers like the Bug, the Dniester, Dnieper, Don, and Volga. They hunted wild horses and gazelle and aurochs. The people of Old Europe were farmers who herded sheep, goats, and cattle and tended cereal grains and lentils. They spoke different languages, they performed different religious rituals, and they buried their dead differently. Most frontiers don't really last very long. Decades, maybe a couple of centuries, before back-and-forth movements of people and ideas create some new blend and obliterate that line. The frontier between the steppe and Old Europe, on the other hand, lasted in some form for several thousand years. Now, that doesn't mean nothing crossed the frontier. That's absolutely not the case. Raw copper and finished copper artifacts were sought after luxury items, and they traveled east into the grassland either as trade goods or more likely as gifts between powerful people, between leaders. Much more important, the foragers living in the river valleys closest to Old Europe adopted domesticated animals from their new neighbors. They started herding cattle in large numbers, an innovation that had spread east across the steppes to about the Volga River by about 4500 BC. This was a pretty dang transformative thing for reasons that we'll talk about in much greater detail in our next episode. For now, suffice to say that herding transformed the subsistence patterns and culture of the steppe peoples. That's because by about 4200 BC, some of the steppe people had started to domesticate and ride horses. This is important for us as we're talking about Old Europe because right around that time, in the few centuries between about 4200 BC and 4000 BC, the world of the Tells, with its orderly villages, fields, and goddess figurines and sophisticated copper production, completely fell apart. All of the Tells in Old Europe, the whole region of the Danube Valley, Bulgaria, and Moldova, were abandoned. These central places where people had lived for hundreds or thousands of years were completely deserted. So were most of the flat settlements in between, where as many or more people had lived. The copper production stopped. The rich graves like the ones at Varna no longer appeared. The whole way of life changed. Far fewer people living in more temporary settlements and generally herding instead of farming occupied what had been the heartland of Old Europe. How did this happen? How could a whole society, a whole way of life that had lasted for so long, collapse so completely? It's not entirely clear, but we have some suggestive clues. So first, the climate went through a severe downturn, one of the most serious cold snaps since the Younger Dryas, around 4200 BC. This region was densely populated, a combination of heavy grazing, deforestation, takes lots of firewood to make all that copper and pottery, and reduced crop yields due to the cold would have had a seriously negative cumulative effect. The Tell communities, whatever kind of political or social unit they represented, might have started looking at each other's fields and herds with envy. That is a recipe for internal conflict. Second, if the cold snap reduced crop yields in Old Europe, it would have been equally hard on the newly minted cattle herders of the steppe. In harsh conditions, the best place to keep your herds over the winter is in a marshy river delta. Fodder is more accessible and it's sheltered from winter storms, plus you can do some fishing in the lake. The Danube Delta would have been the perfect place to do all that, if not for the fact that it was already occupied by those old European Tell communities. In this period between about 4200 BC and 4000 BC, we can start to see some archaeological evidence of migration from the steppe. Horse bones, something that had never been common outside the steppe, start to show up in Old Europe. So do some pretty cool-looking maces with stone heads shaped like animals. Again, mostly horse heads. Nothing like that existed in Old Europe before. At that same time, a new style of burial started to show up in the Danube Delta region. Raised mounds, called kurgans, which contained the remains of important people who were buried with rich funeral offerings, like gold and weapons. These graves belonged to what archaeologists call the Suvorovo culture. Soon after the cold snap began, and the migrants showed up near the Black Sea along the lower Danube, the old Europeans started to leave the Tells. This was not a peaceful process. At the Tell site of Yunatsite in southern Bulgaria, the final layer from this period contains evidence of intense burning mixed with the skeletons of 46 people who appear to have died violently. Some old Europeans near Bucharest dispersed into smaller settlements, like the five or six houses at the site of Hilava, but that too was burned to the ground. In all, some 600 Tell settlements in the lower Danube and eastern Bulgaria were abandoned in this period. Think back to what we discussed earlier, how the Tells and the houses perched on top of them weren't just places to live in, but the linchpins in how their occupants organized and thought of the world. Again, a Tell was a communal construction. It was a reflection of the community and the individuals who had built it, going all the way back into the mists of ancestral time. Abandoning a Tell was a profound statement about the end of a particular lineage, a clan, or group of whatever kind, however the old Europeans defined themselves. Abandoning all of them, hundreds of them, was the end of something much larger. Through some combination of increased internal competition, changing climate, and probably the arrival of newcomers from the steppe, the old European heartland disintegrated. If I had to guess, it looks like a combination of environmental degradation, social stress, and horseback raiding parties from the steppe all played some kind of role. But that's not to say that old Europe as a whole was finished. To the west, in western Romania and Bulgaria, some aspects of the old ways survived. Two-story mud brick houses, for example, though they were built on hard-to-reach natural high points rather than artificial tells. To the northeast, that formerly stark frontier between the steppe and the world of the farmers had been breached, not just by the Suvorovo culture migrants who came west and south to the lower Danube, but by farmers moving east and north to occupy the river basins of the Dniester and the Bug rivers, which had formerly been forager territory. A new culture, one rooted in old Europe but with more input from the steppe, came into existence. Archaeologists call it the Cucuteni Tripilia, or Tripolie, culture. It was this new and creative arrangement that led to the megasites, the huge and unprecedented agglomerations of hundreds of houses and thousands of people that we talked about all the way back at the beginning of today's episode. The Cucuteni Tripilia culture had actually been around for quite some time before the megasites came into existence around 4000 BC. I said earlier that it was rooted in old Europe, and this is true, but its core region, basically the eastern foothills of the Carpathian Mountains facing the steppe, actually sat at the meeting point of several different farming cultures. People of the Kuros-Krish culture, the early farmers pushing north from the Aegean, were the first into the region around 5800 BC. They were followed by LBK farmers, who came south and east from Central Europe after about 5100 BC and built their distinctive timber longhouses on the edges of the river valleys that border the steppe. These weren't the last influences either. Old Europe lay directly to the south, with its tell settlements and copper smelting and fine pottery and goddess figurines, and the Cucuteni Tripilia core region eventually became what you might think of as the northern extension of that old European culture. So even before the steppe people really entered this story, the Cucuteni Tripilia people were already exposed to a whole bunch of different and creative cultural traditions. But because this region bordered the steppe, where they encountered first the foragers and then the herders who called the grasslands and river valleys home, the Cucuteni Tripilia people were also exposed to a whole other range of much different influences. Three major rivers, traveling mostly north-south, segmented the grassland. First the Dniester, then the southern Bug, then the Dnieper. The Cucuteni Tripilia people were the first farmers to breach what had been the firm frontier between foragers and farmers along the Dniester in what's now Ukraine and Moldova, around 5000 BC. After that, they steadily filled up the landscape between there and the southern Bug River, the next major waterway, which drains into the Black Sea to the west of the Crimean Peninsula. They went still further from there, into the uplands between the southern Bug and the Dnieper River. That became the new frontier between the people of the steppe, now herders of cattle and sheep rather than foragers, and the farmers. For the better part of 1,000 years, this cultural boundary remained in place, though with plenty of back and forth across it. The Suvorovo people, who came from the steppe into the Danube Delta in old Europe, maybe horseback raiders led by powerful chieftains, well, they must have passed through Cucuteni Tripilia territory on their way. They presumably knew their farming neighbors beforehand. These interactions weren't necessarily happy or peaceful. Between 4300 BC and 4000 BC, right when old Europe came into crisis and the tells were abandoned, a whole bunch of Cucuteni Tripilia farming settlements in the steppe river valleys were surrounded by ditches and earthen embankments. They were usually already built at the edges of steep promontories, and the access was then cut off with ditches as much as 15 feet wide and 10 feet deep. That's a lot of work. You generally don't do that without a good reason. And at the same time, a lot more flint projectile points, arrows, show up in Tripilia sites. All of that suggests a period of increased conflict, though whether that was with the steppe people or other farmers is impossible to say. The old European heartland didn't survive, but the Cucuteni Tripilia culture did. And it didn't just survive, it expanded dramatically. Far more and bigger sites started to show up. It seems likely that some of the people who abandoned the tells migrated northeast. They joined the Cucuteni Tripilia farming communities with their safe embankments and ditches. There was probably a lot of natural population growth, too. This was good, fertile agricultural land with plenty of space to expand. And there were probably some migrants from the east, too. I mentioned the horse-headed stone maces that show up in graves in the old European lands as the tells were abandoned. Well, they appear in Cucuteni Tripilia settlements too. So do inhumation graves, something that was common in the steppe but almost unheard of in old Europe, along with a particular kind of shell-tempered pottery that steppe peoples made. The genetic evidence also suggests some back and forth, with late Cucuteni Tripilia people showing fairly recent gene flow from steppe populations. The decades on either side of about 4000 BC were an incredibly dynamic and unsettled time in this part of the world, where the Black Sea meets the grassy steppe and the forested river valleys. Raiding was probably common, with cattle thievery and settlement destruction followed by revenge raids and vicious cycles that maybe even amounted to full-blown warfare. But there was also migration, the exchange of luxury items like flint and copper, the spreading of cultural practices and technologies, and intermarriage. This was the context in which those enormous megasites started to appear on the Ukrainian steppe. The megasites were a really curious phenomenon. Depending on the criteria you choose, they might be the earliest cities anywhere on the planet. But they didn't leave behind an urban tradition of any kind. There was nothing you could call a city in this region for another few thousand years afterward. They weren't especially densely populated. All of them had concentric circular rings of houses, anywhere between two or three and six of these rings, but they also had plenty of open space at the center of the settlement and between the rings. There are no fortifications, there are no city walls or palisades or big ditches or embankments. The houses themselves were of the same type Kukueteni Tripilia people had built at their normal settlements. Some were bigger than others, but there were no palaces, there were no signs of leaders or even much of a hierarchy. There were buildings that looked like they had a public function, maybe places of worship or feasting halls or something like that, but there was nothing like the enormous temples that cropped up in the classic cities of Mesopotamia. So what in the world was going on here? Over the course of a few generations, a whole bunch of these kinds of settlements, the smallest of them, five times the size of any preceding site, popped up all over the southern Ukrainian forest steppe. Again, nothing like them had ever existed before. That's one of the major points of a recent large-scale study of these sites, led by the archaeologists John Chapman, Bizerka Gedarska, and Marko Nebia. These big agglomerations of people have to be understood as a totally novel thing. But that doesn't mean they appeared out of nowhere. Each of their elements, aside from their sheer size, had predecessors. The houses, as I mentioned, were totally standard. There had been circular rings of houses before, with outer dwelling spaces and inner open spaces within a settlement. And for at least a while before this, settlements had been getting larger, integrating increasing numbers of smaller settlements into some kind of network at greater and greater distances from the core site. This is called a settlement hierarchy. We also have to cut the megasites down to size, so to speak. The most recent pieces of scholarship on them have argued that despite their vast extent, the houses weren't all permanently occupied by huge numbers of people. Now, theoretically, one of these megasites might have held tens of thousands of people at once, but in reality, it would have had either a much smaller permanent group, seasonal occupation by large groups that came to the site from some distance away, or, more likely, some combination of those. On top of that, whole areas of houses, neighborhoods or quarters within the megasites, were intentionally burned at once. Unlike the tell sites that had so intentionally burned layers of houses, these ones weren't leveled. Their remains were left standing, and they weren't built over. The archaeobotanical evidence, pollen basically, tells us that there was nowhere near enough land cleared in the places near the megasites to grow enough grain to feed tens of thousands of people. The land use patterns revealed by the pollen don't change enough when the megasites come into existence to support the idea of, like, sudden urban growth. But even if they weren't quite as populous as we might have assumed just by looking at the sites, they were still the biggest collections of people in the world. Those same recent studies have estimated that a single two-story house, 15 meters by 5 meters, would have taken 10 to 12 people a month to construct. There were hundreds, thousands of these houses on a single site. The materials had to be brought in, huge amounts of timber from forests that weren't necessarily close. The houses were equipped with all the normal things that Kukueteni Tripilia houses usually had, particularly their fine pottery and their goddess figurines and things like that. There are tons of animal bones, there's waste from craft production, there's kilns, ovens, things like that. People did, in fact, spend a lot of time at these places. These weren't purely ritual sites, the kind of thing where you showed up for one day or a week every year and then left them. And there were a lot of these places, particularly as we move from around 4000 BC toward 3700 BC when they peaked, to about 3400 BC when they fell out of use. So we have this widespread phenomenon, it stretches over hundreds of miles, that involved thousands of people over more than 600 years. That is a pretty striking thing, and it's what defines the late period of the Kukueteni Tripilia culture. How should we explain this? Why build these places and keep coming to them over and over and over? Maybe. Like the fortifications in this region that preceded the megasite phase, these groupings of people were for defense. Raiders might attack isolated hamlets or even towns with a few hundred inhabitants, but a few thousand people were a much stiffer test. And while there were no formal fortifications, the houses were built right up against one another. They formed a pretty solid ring that was only open through a few easily defensible streets. I'm sure this was part of it, but there has to be more going on here. The authors of that recent study, Chapman, Gedarska, and Nebia, propose three new models that account for the lower-than-expected populations and the huge size of the megasites. In the first, a megasite would have a small permanent population drawn from a wider area. It would have been kind of a center of governance or a representative place for a whole region of maybe 100 square kilometers that contributed to its upkeep. In the second model, a megasite would have had that small permanent population, but it would have drawn in much larger groups for some restricted period in the year for a major assembly that lasted maybe a month. In the third and final model, a megasite would still have had the small permanent group of residents, but it would have functioned as a center for pilgrimage, presumably religious in nature, using the streets and open spaces for group processions. Now, none of these are mutually exclusive, as the authors point out. They're simply models. We don't have to see some stark division between assembly and pilgrimage and governance. Particularly when we're dealing with a very alien past, people whose assumptions about the world were much different from our own, they might not have understood any of those things as separate. The core thing about these sites, seems to me, is that they're markers of some kind of identity. Identity for the specific local area that each megasite served, and more broadly, the identity of all of the people who gathered at them across a pretty big region in the forest steppe of the Ukraine. If we think about these sites emerging in the aftermath of conflict and increased contact with people on the steppe, people with a different language, different beliefs, different subsistence practices, just a much different way of life all around, it would make sense that that stimulated some new things in response. If we believe the really extensive anthropological scholarship on identity, well, then frontiers are the places where ethnic and cultural identities are felt most strongly, and where they're forged. We see other people who are different from us, and we formulate our own thoughts about who we are in response. Identity is thus relational rather than absolute. It seems to me that the megasites are exactly the kind of response we'd expect to see if your way of life had been seriously challenged, the long-lived settlements in the heartland of your civilization had been destroyed, migrants had been forced to move elsewhere and think a lot about precisely who they were in relation to other people. You'd come together with people like you who shared your way of life, characteristics you recognized as a sign of belonging. You'd build huge collections of your characteristic houses and then ritually burn them. You'd engage in feasts and religious processions. You'd exchange goods and ideas and marriage partners with the groups that you were most closely connected to. The steppe people were present in the Kukuteni Tripilia world. We know that thanks to their graves and their horsehead mesas and what have you. They were there, a capital O other, against whom the Kukuteni Tripilia people could define themselves. I think the megasites were an expression of that process, one particular way for these people to make a visible statement about who they were and what they believed. But eventually, the megasites too were abandoned. The fields around them went fallow, the houses collapsed, and no more processions tramped down the narrow streets toward the big open spaces at their centers. Herders from the steppe raised their sheep and cattle in the places where timber-framed gathering halls had stood. They carried weapons made of bronze and rode horses. They built their burial mounds, called kurgans, on top of the abandoned homes and placed their illustrious dead inside to mark the landscape as theirs. The Kukuteni Tripilia culture eventually passed into the abyss, and a much different world followed it. This was the world of the steppe, of a group we know as the Proto-Indo-Europeans, who spoke a language ancestral to English, Spanish, Russian, Persian, Bengali, and many more languages. Next time, we'll explore their grassland home and try to understand how and why their language eventually spread over half the planet. Until then, thanks for joining me today. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com. That's patrickwyman.substack.com. where I'm posting pictures and video in a post to go along with each episode. I also write essays on current events and historical perspective, but feel free to skip those if you just want the prehistory. Again, that's patrickwyman.substack.com. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show on both of those platforms at Tides History. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.